This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we bring you a reprise of a nighttime walk on the beach that was recorded in the first winter after KPTZ went on the air back in January of 2012. It's a program that was occasioned by this reporter's realization that between the autumnal and vernal equinoxes, the extreme low tides are always at night, a fact that turns out to have profound implications in the lifestyles of shellfish farmers. Curiosity about those lifestyles led me to gooey duck farmer Peter Downey, who since 2003 has cultivated about 50 acres of tidelands on the eastern shore of Discovery Bay. I met Downey at his comfortable home nestled in the woods a few miles from his saltwater farm. A full moon shone through broken clouds as we climbed into his big SUV. He launched right into his narrative as he drove me down a circuitous route to his seaside staging area.
We lease property from the Gunstone family, and Gunstones and Broders own a lot of the tideland in Discovery Bay, and they have, actually it's kind of interesting, they have both timber and shellfish. If you have ever looked at the west coast of Discovery Bay, you know, sitting here on the Quimper Peninsula side and look across, you don't see a whole lot of houses over there. It's all trees. Well, that's all Gunstone land. And I think that's really what saved Discovery Bay. You end up with a working forest as opposed to a bunch of houses and development because it could easily become an extension of Squim if someone was so inclined. Anyway, so we lease about 50 acres or so that we lease, and of that 50 acres, there's about 15 acres that is good for gooey duck, and that's really our primary focus is gooey duck, but we also do oysters as well. Gooey duck is an interesting thing because you can't just grow it anywhere. It is extremely particular. It needs to have deep sand, deep sediment. You can't have hardpan or mud or cobbles or anything else. It has to have a certain kind of sediment. It has to have real good water quality, of course. It also has to have real high salinity. 30 seconds of fresh water will kill a gooey duck. So they really can't stand too much in the way of fresh water.
So that means that they can't really be in the tidal zone because if it rains, it'll kill them?
No. If it rains, it's not that bad. You know, but what happens is you get like by the mouth of rivers, you get some stratification, and you'll get, during flood period, you'll get 4 or 5 feet of fresh water sitting over the top. And if that's just sitting over the top for an extended period of time, it'll wipe out all the gooey duck there. So typically you won't see, you'll see oysters and clams in the mouths of rivers, but the gooey duck just can't stand it. They can't tolerate it. There's a lot about the gooey duck that we don't understand. We do all of our gooey duck planting in the summer. In the wintertime, it's pretty much just maintenance and a little bit of harvest. Although this year we didn't have a very good plant year in 2006, and it takes 5 years to get a crop of gooey duck.
And why was 2006 a bad year?
It's seed issues. The hatcheries just did not produce seed that year. And our shellfish, for the most part, comes from hatcheries. You know, there is some wild catch of oysters out in Willapa and Daybob Bay and then Hood Canal. But all the gooey duck and most of the oysters at this point in time is being produced by the hatcheries. And then we place it out onto the tidelands. So we really are dependent upon the hatcheries to make things work for us. And if the hatcheries have a bad year, then we have a bad year. And with gooey duck, it takes 5 to 7 years to get a product. You know, it's just kind of the nature of farming.
So you see you've got a little ATV over here, is that?
We do a lot, almost all of our work we do with ATVs. And it's going to be quite the hike out there, too. We've got about a mile of hike to get to the oyster beds.
A mile?
Yeah. I didn't tell you that beforehand. When I first started this farm, I was doing a lot more access by boat. And The wind can come up on this bay amazingly fast. You know, going from pretty much dead calm like it is right now to having 35 knots of wind and having no more than like 15 or 20 minutes of warning on it. And I just decided that, you know, if I'm really going to make the farm work, I have to be able to work it from the upland side. Because Discovery Bay, water access is really limited. There's no commercial access point in Discovery Bay. You know, you've got...
You mean there's no boat ramp or...
The boat ramp in Gardner is for recreation. There's... Beckett Point has kind of a boat ramp, not much of one, but that's for Beckett Point members. Right. Cape George has a nice marina and ramp, but that's for Cape George members, and it's really residential, and it's not really geared for commercial production. The nearest commercial port is Port Townsend, which is about 8 miles away on the water, and you have to go around Point Wilson. And if you know anything about
Point Wilson... Which is a hazardous passage, yeah.
It's some of the roughest water in the state. You know, you got all the water, especially when we're accessing it, because we're working the tides. So that means when the tide is at maximum ebb and maximum flood, that's when we're having to come into and out of port. Yeah, because when the tides slack, that's when we're out on the beach.
So how did you develop your markets? I mean,
for a gooey duck, there's nothing to developing a market. The market is there. When I first put my business plan together in 2003, gooey duck was selling for about $7 a pound wholesale, you know, and so I figured, well, if I could figure out a net way to net out about $5 a pound, it was a viable commodity. You know, and at that point in time, seed was being sold for about 2 or 3 cents a piece, and so the numbers all worked out.
And an average gooey duck weighs out at how much?
Farm product, pound and a half to 2.5 pounds. You know, so that was in 2003 when I was first doing my business plan. And at that point in time, China made up about 5% of the market. Since then, China now makes, for the farm product, probably makes up about 95% of the market.
Wow, so most of your stuff is shipped to China?
Oh yeah, the gooey duck is all shipped to China.
None of it is sold in restaurants in Port Townsend?
Not too much. We do take some to Ichikawa. That's Beckett Point right up here. Bay. The head of the bay is about 9 miles away, where we have Salmon Creek and Snow Creek. This is a really high salinity beach. We're, you know, we usually see about 30 parts per million for salinity, which is right up there. It's essentially ocean conditions. It's a minus 0.8 tide tonight, but with the high pressure system that's been sitting in, we're sitting down right now at about a minus 1.5, minus 2 tide level. It's high pressure pushes the tide out much more. So we're kind of at nature's mercy that way too.
How hard was it for you to get used to the schedule you have to keep at this time of year?
how hard was it, or how hard is it? I mean, the thing is, you know, tides follow the equinoxes. So when we get spring equinox, the tides switch to daytime low tides. So from March through September, we'll have low tide in the middle of the day. You know, and so you're out there in the middle of the summer, the tide's out, you're working. It's a great place to be. In the wintertime, from September through March, we have low tides in the middle of the night. And so we have to be out in the middle of the night working our tide flats, because that's when they're available. You know, it's just one of those things. And it's really hard in the fall to switch to the nighttime low tides, you know, because you'll be up sometimes till 4 or 5 in the morning. And then, of course, the rest of your business happens during the day like everybody else. You know, so people will call you up at 8 o'clock in the morning.
But what time would you have to, I mean, on the night that you're out there until 4 or 5 in the morning, what time are you going out?
Oh, we usually get about 5 or 6 hours on the beach. So we'll go out at...
At 11 or...
At 11 or so, yeah.
But do you try to sleep before you go out? I mean, what do you do?
Yeah, yeah. The one trick is, if you have a really late tide, you go to bed at, you know, 7 or 8 o'clock and try to get a few hours of sleep in before you hit the beach. Otherwise, you just become a zombie. And even then, you know, we're all shellfish farmers in the winter are kind of sleep deprived. It just goes with the territory.
Well, so now why is it so vital that you get out there that often? I mean, you have to do harvesting. What other work are you doing out
there? Well, we do maintenance as well. And you'll see, you know, with the gooey duck, we'll have some gooey duck tubes that'll come and get washed up. And we have to continually, you know, maintain our beds. With the oysters, we're doing bag-on-bottom oysters and some bag-on-rack oysters. And those systems have to be maintained, especially with these storms that we get. You know, the storms they can tear things up pretty well. We are a pretty high-energy beach.
Oh, is that right? I mean, I always thought that Discovery Bay looked sort of protected. I mean, it's,
well,
you know, an inlet and it's not a...
See where that light is on the hill?
Yes.
That's just about due south, okay? So we have a good 5 or 6 miles of fetch coming down here.
So you get some pretty big waves coming
down. Yeah, and, you know, we get 60-knot sustained winds.
Over, and that's where the big storms come from, is the south.
Well, Discovery Bay is really strange, you know, because... It can be blowing down the canal and it'll be calm here. It can be calm everywhere else and it'll be blowing in Discovery Bay. It's a weird anomaly. It has to do with the rain shadow effect from the Olympics. The center of the blue hole, the center of the rain shadow, is actually about 2 miles north of Protection Island. And so you get these strange winds through Discovery Bay, through the Squim area, through, and a little bit through Port Towns. But, you know, it can be raining everywhere else in Puget Sound, and it'll be sunny here. And so we have much, much different weather than probably anywhere else in Western Washington. The one thing that you can pretty well count on is that it's going to be blowing, especially in the wintertime.
Do you recall a particular storm that did a particularly large amount of damage out here?
Well, actually, it's interesting. You know, we're kind of set up for having to deal with this winds from the south. In 2007, it was a January night, and we had all of a sudden this huge storm come in from the north, and we had about 60-knot winds from the north, and we literally got blown off the beach. We had to vacate, but I don't know if you noticed at the landing where we came in, there was a lot of eelgrass way high up on the beach,
uh-huh.
You know, up to about a +3 tide line. Which isn't really too normal. It has to be pretty protected to get up that high. Well, on that one night, it scoured that entire beach and took all that eelgrass and threw it up at the high tide line. And it took about 4 years for that eelgrass to come back to reseed itself. You know, it's just Mother Nature has its own way of doing things. Now, whether you realize it or not, we've been walking on the farm for quite a ways. These are all gooey duck beds through here.
I see it's suddenly gotten quite a bit smoother
very
here.
Sandy.
Yeah, very sandy. So now I've actually been in other gooey duck farms where they have them in plastic tubes where you can them easily.
That's only for the first couple years of the life cycle. What happens is we use the plastic tubes to protect the baby gooey duck because the baby gooey duck, they're like popcorn on the beach. Anything that'll eat a clam will eat a gooey duck first. It can't get into its shell. It's just like an adult. Its only protection is to dig deep. But when you're really small, you can only get, you know, 3 inches into the sand. And so diving ducks and starfish and moon snails and anything that will eat a clam will come along and clean out the gooey duck first because there's essentially no protection for them. The wintertime, gooey duck do what they do best and they hide. And so you won't really see them very well. But if you know what you're looking for...
You stomp on the ground like that
stomp to make them show.
Yeah, there's one.
There's one. But there's a lot more here than or what is really showing.
There's a couple more.
Yeah.
So when you go to harvest these, you have to dig with a spade? Or, I mean, No.
We use a water pump and hydraulics. So
you blast them out?
No, you don't blast them. It's low pressure, high volume of water. And so what you're doing is you're washing the sand away, reaching your arm all the way into the hole till you get the shell, and then pulling it out. So you'll be lying on the ground with the hose, what we call a stinger, and then you loosen up the gooey duck and you pull it out, each one out by hand.
So we're not going to be doing that tonight?
No. We're not doing any harvest. You know, it's...
As you stomp the sand and you see one of these fountains that come up. How do you evaluate whether the gooey duck that's down below there is ripe for harvest?
Because I know exactly when they were planted.
I see. So okay. So you have like regions of the beach that you
right.
plant on.
Right. So that was 2007. This is our 2006 plant right here. And for the most part, it's been harvested out. There's still a few animals here and there. But for the most part, our 2006, which was not a very good year, has been harvested. And then this right
so
here.
So that, that leaves very little to harvest for the rest of this year.
Then. Right. So that's why, you know.
Is that going to mean financial hardship for your business?
It's been an interesting year financially. It didn't pencil out the way I wanted it to this year at all. But and it's expensive to plant.
So here we have a forest of tubes. So these must be the young ones you were talking
this
about.
This is 2011. This was planted this summer. Sometimes in the wintertime, you know, for a gooey duck farmer, the worst thing you can do is come out in the middle of winter and look for gooey duck, especially young ones, because you won't see anything. And it gets so discouraging. And after 6 years of planting like that, I kind of know that not to expect too much when I look out here right now.
But you know that there's a gooey duck in each one of these, right?
There's three. We plant three in each.
So what is this? Is just like plastic sewer pipe or something?
It's Schedule 10 PVC pipe, about 10 inches long. We push it into the ground a good 6 inches or so, leave about 3 or 4 inches sitting up, and it creates a little tide pool.
Then you put a screen over the top.
Just put a screen over the top.
Which I guess keeps the moon snails and so on out of there.
Well, and it keeps the gooey duck there when we first plant. Gooey duck, in the wintertime, they do what they do best. They hide. They really go dormant from about October through February. They've stored up a lot of food. They kind of hang out and wait till the phytoplankton comes back. So their real growth period is from late February through the end of October.
How did gooey ducks get such a weird name?
Gooey duck. I've heard, and I think this is probably right, it's Salish for dig deep. The story is on that is there was a guy putting together a natural history dictionary of the Pacific Northwest and sent it back east to be published. And his editor saw gooey duck and read about this clam that burrows 3 or 4 feet into the sand and said, oh, he didn't mean G-O-E duck, he meant geoduck of the earth. You know, and so they changed the spelling on it to so it looks like geoduck now. So, but the correct pronunciation is gooey duck. It's actually something we do so we can tell who's from around here and who's not. You know, it's like squim and enumclaw and Puyallup and everything else.
So statistically, about how much seed did you put out? Do you know how many animals?
We're doing, it's about 90,000 animals per acre. So about 220,000 animals a year, something like that. And looking for about 50% survival. It's all kind of a numbers game with gooey duck. A female gooey duck every year will put out 5 million eggs. And the oldest fecund female that they found was 105 years old.
Wow.
And so if you're putting out a half a billion eggs in your lifetime, that tells me that you're really, really, really bad at reproduction. If you're having to put out that many eggs to try and reproduce yourself and a mate and, you know, try to get survival of your species, that's just terrible. And so what we're trying to do as farmers is trying to take the natural systems and give them a leg up. And that's why we have the protection for the young. That's why we do a lot of work with the hatcheries. And even then, we kill a lot more animals than we'll ever harvest.
Now, how do the hatcheries go about capturing and raising their seed?
What they do is they take adult animals and then put them in a tank and feed them for about a month and a half, and get them so that they're nice and fat and plump. And then they do a temperature shift on them. Well, they'll suddenly increase the water temperature back and get them to spawn. You know, so gooey duck are a broadcast spawner where the females will spew their eggs into the water column, the males will spew the sperm into the water column. It mixes in the water column. And for the first month or month and a half, they're just a free-floating zooplankton. And so they're at the mercy of the current. The chance that any two wild gooey duck on my beach are related is about the same as the chance of a wild gooey duck on my beach and one in the South Sound being related. There's just that much mixing before they ever settle out.
There's that much circulation of the water in the
right,
Puget Sound.
Right.
So now you were saying something earlier about water quality.
Yeah, water quality is essential for shellfish farmers, because if we don't have clean water, we don't have a job. There's two different things going on with geoduck right now. We have the geoduck farms, and then we have the wild harvest. And traditionally, it's been wild harvest, and there's been a lot of angst from the state's perspective on doing geoduck farming because they didn't want to displace their wild production. But the reality is, if you want to sustain food production, you're going to have to do some sort of farming. The one thing that human species has going for it is we figured out how to farm.
It's just I see the caps summer. Are off here now.
Yeah, the caps are off. You can see the animals are a little bit bigger. You can actually see them. So next summer we'll come in and pull all these tubes out of here, and then I call them free-range geoduck at that point in time. You know, the geoduck right now are probably about 2 feet down. Once they put down their foot, they're pretty much there for the rest of their life. Body is 3 to 4 feet down below the sand.
Right.
And their only defense is to pull their siphon in. And so when you go after a geoduck, it's not digging away. It's not like razor clams. Razor clams actually dig and move. Geoduck just pull their siphon in. Typically, they're about 3 or 4 inches in diameter and about maybe 6 or 7 inches long.
Right.
Well, their foot for digging is about as big as the last digit or so of my little pinky. They really can't dig their body down very fast at all.
Right.
You know, and so once their body is down there, they just stay. And they push their siphon up and down, and that's where the prized meat is.
In the siphon?
In the siphon, yeah.
You know, what defines the price?
It's all driven by demand. You know, right now, the DNR just had a wild sale where the price went for $18 a pound in the water for the wild product. The farm product is typically $5 to $6 above that.
Oh, those are good prices.
Yeah, those are good prices, but it probably costs about $250,000 an acre to put in a geoduck farm and maintain it, and you've got to sit on that investment for 5 to 7 years before you see it coming back out again. So
that's pricey.
That's pricey. It is pricey. I told you when I first started out, the seed was going for about 3 cents a piece. Today, that same seed is going for about 50 cents a piece. So
per clam.
So each one of these tubes has three clams in it. That's $1.50 just for the seed. Then you got to add the labor in on top of that, the cost of the tube, the cost of cutting the tube, the cost of pulling the tubes out again. Then there's the harvest cost that goes into that and all the harvest equipment. There's right. a lot of expenses that go on with it.
Well, at those kind of prices, though, 50 cents per clam, it would seem almost worthwhile to get into the business of producing your own seed.
Well, it would, except that it's not a simple thing either. It's a complex system. You know, you have to be able to feed them the right kind of algae to get them to spawn. After they spawn, you have to little zooplankton, a different kind of algae, until they get ready to settle out on the bottom. When you get them to settle out on the bottom, after about a month of them floating around, and they're still microscopic, you have to charge that bottom sand with algae, because when they first settle out on the bottom, they're actually feeding with their foot. Their siphons aren't developed yet, so there's figuring out those systems and the algae that they'll eat when they hit the bottom. So all those systems take a whole lot of knowledge, a whole lot of work, and a whole lot of luck.
Right.
You know,
and investments.
And investment.
Yeah, right.
With the whole acidification of the oceans, especially with oysters, we haven't seen a really decent natural set of oysters in Willapa Bay for, I think it's 6 or 7 years now. You know, and this really happened
That's related to global warming.
It is. It's related to climate change, carbon dioxide buildup in the atmosphere that the ocean is a giant sink for it, and it hits the ocean and then gets heavy. That heavier water drops down to the bottom. It's high acid water. The Pacific Northwest is kind of ground zero for the acid levels in the world. We get these circulation of this deep water that comes up. North winds blow off the coast and will actually raise that water up off the bottom. And it was the Whiskey Creek Hatchery out in Neatard's Bay was having huge problems with mortality. And then they figured out it was the acid levels, and they could actually monitor the winds off the coast and the acid levels out in the ocean. And as soon as it hit their hatchery, all their spat died. You know, and so they had to, you know, you're going to see whole-scale changes in the zooplankton. Those microscopic shellfish of one kind or another that aren't going to be able to form shells. And you're going to have different zooplankton that can tolerate it or maybe even thrive in it that are going to come about. What's that going to do to the whole food chain? We have no idea. Nobody knows. You know, and who knows? It might be great for rockfish and terrible for salmon. Might be great for salmon, terrible for rockfish. You know, we just don't, we don't have any of those answers whatsoever.
Now, what do you do with moon snails when you see them?
Nothing. What we're doing for predator control today is so different from what has been traditional shellfish farming back. You know, I talked about everyone changes systems. Farmers need to change systems. One of the big things that shellfish farmers have done for changing systems is their predator control. We have really gone to passive predator control systems. So tubes and nets, as opposed to actually going out and killing starfish or killing moon snails. You know, it's just much more effective to have systems that worked.
Have you ever fooled around with any other shellfish, you know, mussels?
I killed about 10,000 manila clams. Figured out that I didn't know how to grow those. They didn't like this beach at all. It's just, this beach moves so much that, you know, I can handle the oysters in the bag like that. If I was to put oysters directly on the bottom, they would be smothered in the first storm. You know, with the bags, what we can do is we get a big storm that will start to bury some of them, and we can come out and, you saw he had that big gaff hook. He's out there turning bags right now. The winter time cuts the cloth for shellfish farmers. You know, you figure out if you can do it or not in the winter. You know, especially if we were doing geoduck harvest. You know, out here in the middle of the night, harvesting geoduck, if it's like 38 degrees with a little bit of wind blowing and the water is actually warmer than the air, there's just no way you get warm. Yeah, because you're wet. Yeah, you're lying down on the wet sand, and I've had pretty bad hypothermia a few times. Last year my lips were blue and I was slurring my words. I got home and ran the bath, got a big glass of tea and drank that down, hot tea, ran the bath and sat in the bath for about 30 minutes, hot as I could stand it, got out of the bath and climbed into bed at about 4 in the morning, and my wife says, "Oh, you're cold to the touch." And I was sitting in the bath for about 10 minutes before I started shivering. That's how cold I was. It was not good. Yeah, so you gotta watch. I still haven't found the correct system for working out here as far as clothing. We've tried dry suits, they leak. We've tried wet suits. The problem with a wet suit is you charge it with water and then you warm that water up when you're in a wet suit. But if you're in and out of the water all the time when you're harvesting, because you're not really in the water, you're recharging it with cold water all the time. And so wetsuits don't work at all. Envy some other farmers because they don't have to be out there in the cold and wet in the middle of the night.
Have you tried sealskin?
Sealskin? No, I've never tried sealskin. It's a, you know, you can see its dew tractions when you get in at 4 in the morning and you're dripping wet from head to toe and your body temperature has dropped to about 94 degrees and then some idiot calls you up at 7:30 in the morning because they want to talk to you about some system or something, which happens. In the wintertime, you don't call shellfish farmers up before about 10 o'clock in the morning. That's just a rule of thumb.
This is Steve Evans for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Mondays and Saturdays at noon, Tuesdays at 5 p.m., and Wednesdays at 10 a.m., exclusively here on KPTZ, the home of eclectic, authentic community radio. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.